on MDR, XDR, and second line DST. I'm Kai Man Kam from Hong Kong. I work in the TB reference lab there. And I think this is a fair crowd. So those of you who might have one or two seats with bags on, so please put the bags on the floor and then let the people at the back and sit. Welcome you all. This is going to be a 2 hours and 15 minutes symposium. We will run as scheduled. The only change is that Dr. Masang from South Africa, she may not be able to make it, so we will have four speakers this morning, and we try to keep on time, so about 30 minutes each speaker, and we will try to entertain as many question and answers after each presentation as possible. But I know this is a fair crowd, and I'm very surprised to see the bacteriology and immunology section can have a big crowd these days. Anyway, this symposium is supposed to present the epidemiological situation worldwide, to present the clinical diagnosis, treatment, and outcome of the MDR and XDR-TB, and management from the NTP perspective, and also discuss on the techniques for DST testing. So without further ado, I will pass the chair to Dr. Elvira Richter. Dr. Sabine cannot make it this morning, so Dr. Elvira Richter will act on her behalf. Elvira, please.
Thank you. So now it's my pleasure to introduce Abigail Reif from WHO. She will give us, for sure, an overview over the actual situation concerning MDR and XDR-TB worldwide, I think, which is the basis to know about the size of the problem we have to deal with and the basis of the following talks, what we have to deal with. Thank you, Abby.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you, Dr. Kam and Elvira, for the introduction. My name is Abigail Wright, and I'm part of the drug resistance team in the Stop TB department at WHO. I'm sorry there aren't more seats, but I'll try to go through this rather quickly and leave some room for discussion afterwards. I'm going to give a presentation on some of the recent data collected in the WHO Union Global Project on Drug Resistant Surveillance. Then I'm going to talk about some of the XDR information we've been able to gather through the project. I'll touch on some of the issues in survey methodology, but I won't be going into detail. I'll summarize some of the main issues, but we can discuss it further at the end of this presentation. Let me, for those of you that aren't familiar with the project, just to give you a little bit of background, the project was started in 1994 in order to collect standardized and comparable data across countries on the situation of drug resistance in the world. So the project is, has been going on for about 13 years now. So over the past 13 years, we've managed to receive data from 117 countries in total, or about 57% of the world's countries. You'll see on the left-hand side the dark blue and the light blue bar. The dark blue area is indicating the number of countries that are providing data, trend data, or more than three data points. The light blue indicates the countries that have only been able to provide baseline data. So you'll see that over half of the countries that we've received data from are countries that have really only been able to provide data from one baseline drug resistance survey. In the fourth report, we'll be including data from 83 countries and from about 125 settings. So in some of the larger countries like India, Russia, and China, we'll have multiple sites, provinces, oblasts, or states. 32 of these countries are reporting have never previously reported data, so these are brand new data from countries that in the past we've only estimated rates of resistance in. On the right-hand side is a list of the high TB burden countries. In the blue, these are the countries from which we've received partial data, so subnational data, mainly from states or oblasts or provinces. The countries in black are countries that have been able to report full nationwide data, and the countries in red are the countries from which we still have no representative data. Countries where you see an asterisk are countries, high-burden countries, that have reported data in this report. So we have quite a few high-burden countries represented in this next coming report. And the countries that are italicized are countries that are in the process of conducting a survey, either a repeat survey or a baseline survey, are at some stage of that planning process, either at the beginning or a survey is actually ongoing. It may also be worth mentioning that the full report of the most recent round of data collection will be available in February 2008. And in the second quarter of 2008, we plan to have a survey methods meeting to review the methods that we're using to conduct drug resistance surveillance worldwide. I'd also like to mention that about half of the countries that are reporting trends are reporting routine diagnostic DST data. And the other half are countries that are conducting surveys. So actually, the countries in light blue are primarily countries that are conducting cross-sectional surveys. So if we look across the different WHO regions, you'll see that most of the regions have achieved about 50% coverage of the countries in those regions. And again, there's a little bit of cheating going on in the sense that the larger countries are really only providing partial data because we recommend that surveys take place at a subnational level for large countries. Eastern Mediterranean region is a little bit lower, primarily because there are a lot of difficult countries in this region that are in conflict situations, and so it's perhaps that setting up laboratories is mainly for initial diagnosis and treatment programs, and surveillance is something that will be dealt with at a second stage. Europe has the highest coverage, which isn't surprising given the laboratory capacity in the region. I wanted to highlight some of the new countries that we will receive data from that have never been previously reported in some of these regions. Notably in Africa, there will be new data from Ethiopia, Rwanda, Tanzania, Madagascar, and Senegal. In the Eastern Mediterranean, we will receive data from Syria, Lebanon, Yemen, and Jordan. In Europe, there are new data from new oblasts in Russia, from the Caucasus countries, and from Uzbekistan. And in Southeast Asia, we will have full country data from Myanmar and Sri Lanka and partial data from India and Indonesia. In the Western Pacific region, most importantly, are some new provinces in China and a full nationwide survey from the Philippines. So here's a map depicting the coverage of the project. Again, the countries in yellow are countries that have never previously reported survey data. India, Russia, China, and Indonesia are all reporting new partial data. Countries indicated in green are countries from which we will be reporting fresh data, but these countries have reported data to us in the past. And the countries in blue have reported in previous reports, in the first, second, and third report. The last report was published in 2004. I don't know if you can see on this map some of the hash marks, but the hash marks are intended to depict where countries are planning to run surveys or are currently conducting surveys. So you see that there's actually a lot of survey activity. But the other notable aspect of this map are the huge gaps in Central and Western Africa and in the Middle East. And I also wanted to point out that much of this has to do with laboratory capacity, which has been a strong theme at this meeting. So I think we can expect to see some changes in surveillance, mainly because of the increase in laboratory capacity and a focus on the need to diagnose HIV-infected TB patients as well as drug-resistant TB patients. Again, I wanted to show you a trend map because it is striking. The countries that are reporting trend data are primarily the high-resource countries. Very few countries conducting cross-sectional surveys have been able to report trends. Those countries are Uruguay, Nepal, Thailand, Botswana, and a handful of others. And this is one of the major limitations of this project, and again, one of the reasons that we'll be having a meeting in the second quarter of next year to discuss how we can revise methods in order to collect better trend data from high-burden countries. So on to the data. The data from the last round of surveys, actually, these are data from 1994 through 2007. You're looking at a weighted mean of MDR among new and previously treated patients by region. Globally, you'll see that among new patients, you see about 2.5% of MDR in new TB cases. In retreated cases, you see something around 15%, but a much wider confidence interval. And you'll see that there's a lot of regional variation. I think one of the reasons that there's such large confidence intervals in the Eastern Mediterranean region is because of the few number of countries that have conducted surveys, as well as the low number of cases included in the retreatment sample size. But within this weighted mean, within regions, there's quite a bit of variation. So I also wanted to show you a map of MDR-TB among new cases over the last 13 years. Again, this map, we show it every time we run a round of surveys, and it doesn't change. We just fill in more blanks, but it looks very similar in the sense that you see the highest proportions of resistance among new cases in Russia and in China. You'll also see a few new countries every round of surveys that come up. For example, in Senegal, you'll see just over 3%, Myanmar around 4%, and in Rwanda about 4.5% among new cases. So here I'm depicting the weighted mean of any resistance to four first-line drugs globally among all TB cases. So this is new and previously treated cases combined. And just to mention very quickly, most of the surveys that we run, or the current guidelines for conducting drug-resistant surveys, focus on new cases. The retreatment cases, most countries running a survey will include retreatment cases during the intake period for new cases. We're trying to increase sample size for the retreatment cases, but this is also a very difficult population. It's also a population that's not very easy to compare across countries because it's a very heterogeneous group. So if you have a larger proportion of failures or a larger proportion of defaults, it obviously affects the proportion of resistance you'll see in this group. So the strongest data we have on retreatment population is really among countries that are conducting surveillance. Here I'm showing the weighted mean of any resistance to the four first-line drugs globally among all TB cases. You'll see around 13.2% among, in isoniazid and 12.4% for streptomycin. Now, and lower proportions in rifampicin, ethambutol, and MDR. MDR and rifampicin are closely linked, and this is why everybody always says that rifampicin is actually a very good surrogate marker for MDR, and you'll see that very rarely will you see more than a 1% difference between MDR and overall rifampicin resistance. This relationship, or the ratios between the different groups of resistance, hold very closely in every country that's been surveyed. So if you look at each individual region, you'll see essentially the same relationship. I just wanted to pick out Eastern Europe because I was talking about the range of patterns. Here again, you see roughly the same relationship, but you see a much higher proportion of resistance among all TB cases. So in essence, what we're saying here is that at least 37% of the population is resistant to isoniazid, and 40% of the population is resistant to streptomycin, and streptomycin is still used widely. So this is probably the slide that will be repeated the most in the coming months. This is the ranking order of the highest proportions of MDR among new and retreatment cases. And I've included not just new sites, but sites that have been included in the project since 1994. Although what you'll notice is there, out of the 20 sites or the 20 settings that are listed here, there are only four settings that are indicated by asterisks, and these are settings that are reporting data from previous surveys. So the majority of the high-ranking settings are new surveys. These are new countries or new settings. Kaliningrad Oblast and Arkhangelsk are showing proportions of resistance around 30%. Same with Baku, Azerbaijan. And these are some of the highest proportions among new cases that we've ever seen. You'll see that there's quite a bit of variation among the retreatment cases. And again, I mentioned before, that's because this is a very heterogeneous population. And within survey and surveillance settings, the cases have been measured and included, sometimes in different ways. The other thing I wanted to mention on this slide is that you'll see it ends up being a bit of a laundry list of countries of the former Soviet Union and then China at the bottom. But if we were actually to look at the same slide by burden of disease, India would also join this list, although in terms of proportion of resistance, it's quite a bit lower. And the latest survey from Gujarat is showing a little over 3%. So I wanted to move on to trends, and I'm not going to talk extensively about trends all over the world, but I thought some of the most important trends to look at were trends from countries that are really addressing a very serious MDR-TB epidemic. Here we're looking at new cases in the Baltic countries. On the right-hand side, you'll see proportions of MDR among new cases, using the same scale in all three countries. The middle line is showing the new smear positive notification rate roughly over the same period of time. And in order to interpret proportions of resistance in any population, you also really need to be looking at the absolute numbers, because proportions are obviously very sensitive to denominators. MDR is very rare. And so, in fact, in this population, it is possible to look at it as a rate. But in other populations where it's even more rare, it's very difficult to look at it as a rate. So what I wanted to point out on this slide was that you'll see the proportions of resistance among new cases, proportions of MDR, are actually very steady in most of the Baltic states. You'll see a slight increase in Lithuania, but it's very steady and it's very slow. And this is really after almost 10 years of data. And, you know, we came out with reports in 1997 and 2001 and 2004 where you only had one, two, or three data points. And you can really jump to conclusions very easily, but you really need a good 10 years of data to understand what's going on in terms of resistance. So the message here is that the notification rates in Estonia and Latvia seem to be coming down. In Lithuania, they're going up a little bit. But these are countries that have had good TB control programs for a long time. They started interventions for drug-resistant TB very early, and they still haven't been able to bring down the proportions of resistance any faster than the TB epidemic itself. So in contrast to the Baltics, I wanted to show some trends from some regions in Russia. I have fewer data points, or I've been reported fewer data points over these years, but I'm essentially using the same scale. The other indicators I've used to measure are different because I've had access to different information. You'll see that the slope is a little bit different in Arkhangelsk, Oryol, and Tomsk Oblast. Here we're really looking only at four data points from Arkhangelsk, five from Oryol, and about seven from Tomsk. Although the scale is the same. So you see a slightly different picture in Russia. When you look at the absolute numbers, it seems to be that MDR among new cases truly is increasing in Oryol, at least. In Tomsk, it's a little bit difficult to say. The last 2 years, you've seen an increase in the number of cases. The culture coverage and the DST coverage of the population has been relatively stable. Notification of cases has come down very, very slightly. The middle area, the middle graph that I'm showing there, is a comparison between what you find in the lab registers and what's being reported in terms of MDR-TB cases that have been registered. And you see that they have a pretty good relationship. So for me, the end message here is that in the future, I think as the proficiency testing and the quality assurance of labs rolls out in Russia, we're going to be able to collect very robust data on MDR among new cases. We still need the lab data to have a denominator. But I think what we're seeing here, at least again in Oriel, possibly in Tomsk, and also possibly in Arkhangelsk, is an increase in resistance. But this is reflecting, treatment that had taken place in the past. So these are three regions that are actually doing very well in terms of TB control. Success rates are quite good. MDR TB programs in Tomsk, at least, have been existing for a long period of time, in Oriel for the past several years, I believe. So we'll have to look over the next 3 or 4 years to see what's really happening. But I also wanted to show you some data that were reported from the Russian Ministry of Health. And this is indicating the relative proportions in respiratory cases. Now, this isn't bacteriologically confirmed cases. This is the respiratory cases in Russian Federation. The black indicates chronic cases. The very light gray is indicating relapse cases. The dark gray indicates a proportion of retreatment cases, and the yellow are the new cases. So you'll see these are actually all of the regions for which we'll be including data in the next report. You'll see that for the majority of these regions, new cases are not the highest proportion. The highest proportion of cases are composed of cases that have had treatment for at least one or multiple times. So there's a very large pool of chronic MDR cases in this country, and I think it'll be very difficult to bring down proportions of resistance until chronic cases are truly addressed. I mean, I'm sure there are also infection control elements, but without more sophisticated molecular tools and longitudinal surveillance, it's very difficult to speak directly to the acquisition of resistance versus primary transmission. So I didn't want to show all bad news. There's also some good news here. You'll see on the left-hand side is our data from Hong Kong among all cases. On the right-hand side, data from the U.S., again, all cases. The proportion of MDR in the top section and proportion of any resistance in the bottom section. You see sustained and significant decreases over time. At least in the U.S., and I'll go on to talk a little bit about Western Europe in just a second. But these are countries that have at least a drug-resistant TB situation that reflects very much what's happening outside of the country, because most of the cases are imported. So, therefore, you can really only bring down cases. You can only do so much to bring down cases. The next slide, I'll show all countries in this group are countries with drug-resistant or TB epidemic that's largely imported. On the right-hand side are the proportions of resistance among all cases, proportions of MDR, in fact. The bars are indicating the absolute numbers of cases. So sometimes it's very misleading if you look only at the proportion of resistance, especially in these populations that fluctuate, a fair amount, largely because of immigration. But the thing that's most interesting here, and it's not to say that drug resistance isn't a problem in high-resource countries, because it is, and I think health systems are very, very vigilant, but they're also well-resourced to deal with drug resistance and can help prevent outbreaks with things like infection control and proper DOT and this sort of thing. But what I wanted to point out is that all of these countries are seeing fewer than 100 MDR-TB cases a year. So this is probably the map everyone's been waiting for. The proportion of XDR among MDR-TB is kind of a difficult it's a difficult indicator to measure, in the sense that it's very dependent upon the robustness of the data. Very few countries are still able to test for second-line drugs. And therefore, we've had 41 countries in total report at least one case of XDR. We've received nationally representative data from about 36 countries, but we've received those data in different ways, mainly from high-resource countries at this point. And we've asked for proportions of or specific We've asked for isolate level information, but in some cases we've only received proportion of XDR among MDR. Most countries are still reporting 3-year data because the numbers are so small it's very difficult to interpret otherwise. So here I've shown in the light lavender color countries that have reported less than 3% or less than 2 cases, and I didn't mean to say in a survey, but in a year. So these are countries that are showing very, very, very little problem with XDR, I should say. The countries in the darker purple are between 3 and 10%, and there are very few countries so far that have reported greater than 10% among the total MDR population. The countries that have reported this are Estonia, Ukraine, and I think that's about it. So I wanted to show you the proportion of XDR among MDR in Europe, and these are all the European countries that have reported, data to us. I think in the future we'll probably be looking at XDR among the total population. Here we're using MDR as a denominator, which is very misleading. So if you look at the Central and Western European countries, you see very large confidence intervals, particularly for Slovenia. It's very misleading because Slovenia actually only had 3 MDR-TB cases, I think, over a 3-year period, and one of them was XDR. So that's part of the reason for the large confidence interval. So we have to start looking at XDR in a different way, I think, in terms of total population rather than just as MDR as a denominator. Although, for programmatic reasons, it's useful to look at the proportion of your MDR cases that have extensive second-line resistance. You'll see that the confidence intervals are much tighter in the Eastern European countries, and the proportions in general about the same. We also received data from the Western Pacific region and from the Americas. Again, you see relatively large confidence intervals. The data reported from Australia, from Hong Kong, and from Japan are all surveillance data. Well, Japan was actually a survey. And the data reported from the U.S. is actually over a 6-year period. In general, the Western European countries were reporting a 3-year average. In the next slide, I'll show you the actual numbers so you have a sense of what you're looking at. I know this is kind of a confusing slide, but we have a mix of different settings here. The settings in blue indicate a single year. So this is 1 year of a survey or 1 year of surveillance. The asterisk indicates survey data. So this is a sample. So you're not looking at the total population, but you're looking at a sample of the population. But even in the large countries, I mean, within Estonia, you're looking at 3 years of MDR, and you're looking at 58 cases. It's not that it's small, but we're dealing with small numbers, so you have to keep that in mind. Again, it would be more robust to look in different groups of patients. You would want to look at XDR among new cases, among retreatment cases, and particularly among chronics. At this point, we don't have that information from the majority of countries, so in order to be able to show you all of the countries at once, I've combined all of this information and just used MDR as the denominator. So in summary, the coverage of high-burden countries is expanding. I think that's very positive. Trends are obviously intimately linked to TB control, but reflecting previous years in endemic countries, and you see that there are different trends in the Baltics than in Russia, than in Hong Kong and the U.S. Previously treated is not a good proxy for acquired resistance, I think, in the very beginning of the project or in the early years of rifampicin use, for example. Previously treated could have been used as a proxy for acquired resistance, but we know now that that previously treated cases or resistance among this group is both a result of primary transmission and acquired transmission and a combination of both. We need a better understanding of this population, particularly of chronics, although chronics within countries are a difficult population to get a hold of. Still, many countries aren't actually reporting chronics, and it's hard to find these cases, especially when there's no treatment program available. Cases often return home if treatment isn't available. We have too few trends in survey settings. We're looking towards molecular methods to bypass some of the lab capacity issues. We're already experimenting with this in a few sites, and I think if it goes well, this may be the way forward in terms of determining trends in countries that have that have poor lab capacity. I think over the next few years, countries will be very focused on setting up lab capacity for patients, and again, surveillance will probably be at a second stage, but where human resource capacity is tight, surveillance won't be the first priority, and that's obvious. Confidence intervals, and I didn't show these actually, are very wide in some of the survey settings. And so we're going to have to start piloting alternative survey methods. Again, this is the purpose of the meeting in quarter two of next year, is to talk about some sentinel methods or keeping clusters open over long periods of time to really get a sense of what's happening, particularly with rifampicin resistance. I think most of Eastern Europe is close to using routine data, and perhaps periodic surveys will be used to validate routine data, but I think that's going to be the way in the future. Most of this has to do with making sure that laboratories are quality assured and that cases are classified correctly. And this will be, I think there'll be a stronger focus on data collection systems over the next several years. Something else I think would greatly enhance this project would be the development of additional protocols that could be implemented in selected sites for better longitudinal data, for better understanding of transmission and acquisition. This project is, runs off a few hundred thousand dollars a year, and in general, these nationwide surveys are costing between $50,000 and $70,000 a year. So if you really want to look into things like transmission and acquisition, you can't do it with these cross-sectional baseline surveys. You need something that's a little bit more sophisticated. So I think as a community, we need to start discussing how we can do that and how we can use actually a standardized protocol in several settings so we can still compare that information. XDR, again, is present widely, particularly problematic in countries with MDR and a long use of second-line drugs. So I think wherever you see an MDR problem in a country and you know that second-line drugs have been used for a long period of time, you can expect to see XDR emerging. We have 36 countries reporting data on second-line drug resistance. Over the next year, we should have about 15 additional countries, half of them, I would say, high burden, reporting on second-line drug resistance from survey data. Confidence intervals around XDR-TB are very wide, so we have to think of alternative ways of looking at XDR-TB in the population. One thing I forgot to tell you is that in addition to routine surveillance and nationwide surveys, we're also recommending that many countries that are, or all countries that are starting a GLC project or an MDR-TB treatment program also run something that we call a rapid survey, which may or may not be rapid. But the point is to run a non-nationally representative survey of the population of cases that you intend to treat. And this is the high-risk cases. So looking at the chronics, the Category 2 failures, and based on that information, you have a sense of the emergence of second-line drug resistance in your high-risk population, but it also gives you a basis for formulating a regimen for a treatment program. I think the other thing that we need to consider, and this is kind of counter to what I said before about molecular surveys, is including some of the second-line DST in testing panels for surveys. Right now, the recommendation is to conduct second-line DST on MDR isolates only, and that's purely a practical recommendation because most countries don't have the capacity to do second-line drug susceptibility testing. So those isolates have to be exported to a supranational lab and then tested. And it's not really a very easy thing to do. It's very time-consuming. That's one of the reasons that we're still waiting on, you know, on 10 to 15 countries because it takes a very long time to ship those isolates out and then have them tested. So I think something that we'll probably want to be knowing in the future is the prevalence of quinolone resistance that's emerging in the general TB population. So we may want to start considering replacing streptomycin and ethambutol with, with a quinolone and with an aminoglycoside, something like that. So thank you very much for your attention. I don't know if you have any questions, but I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Abby, for this very informative talk, this huge number of data, and also showing about the problems of presenting and interpreting data. We have now sometimes for maybe three questions. Is there a microphone? Could you please introduce yourself?
Good morning. Good morning. Thank you for your wonderful presentation. I'm Samuel Usman from Nigeria. I just have a slight worry. For 13 years of your project, you got impressive data from several parts of the world, but I'm just worried because my country, Nigeria, happens to have a high prevalence rate of HIV, 4.4%, one of the highest in Africa, I think second to only South Africa. And since data from WHO shows that one out of every three HIV-positive patients have TB, it means we have a high TB problem. But I'm worried because there happens to be no data in the past 13 years from Nigeria. I think your first slide, you showed that there was no data from Nigeria, or it was inconclusive. So I'm worried because if WHO doesn't have a conclusive data, then what can we do in terms of future planning or future interventions? Because we need such data to be able to plan in future the necessary interventions to reduce the burden in my country. Thank you.
Well, Nigeria actually has plans to do a survey, probably not a nationwide survey to start out with, probably of about six districts, something like that. Right now, the protocol is under discussion, and there are plans to improve the laboratory capacity to actually run that survey. So I think there will be data soon. I mean, what I need to say about the surveys is because it's a collaborative project, WHO actually doesn't carry out the surveys. The NTP carries out the surveys, and we and other partners provide assistance, the Supranational Laboratory Network in particular, with the laboratory capacity aspect of it. But it's the NTPs that are carrying out the surveys. And again, one of the reasons that we don't see so many trends is because the survey is actually a massive undertaking, and it means that your laboratory is tied up for about 8 to 14 months, something like that. So it's actually very difficult. But I think that there will be information from Nigeria, probably a survey I would imagine would start sometime late 2008 would be my guess. So I think there will be information. But you brought up another important point, and that is HIV. And I haven't presented this just because of time, but we're starting to collect information about DSC results in HIV-infected TB populations. Right now, in terms of epidemiology, it's not so useful, and that has to do mainly with the proportion of resistance in the population. Often you don't have enough power because your sample has both HIV-infected and uninfected population. You really need to do a kind of a nested case control in order to look at both populations.
Thank you very much for your nice presentation. I'm Mohammed Hassan from Afghanistan. As you mentioned, huge data about MDR in the Russia and China. So what are the reasons? Whether they are not applying DOTS properly there, or HIV epidemic is there, what is the reason?
This is usually when we ask representatives from China and Russia to get up and explain. But in reality, I think in Russia, the discussion is always surrounding the breakup of the former Soviet Union and the chaotic use of drugs and the constant drug shortages, and they talk about that as the beginning of the epidemic, really. In China, I'm not so sure, but I believe that infection control probably plays a very strong role because you have a lot of TB hospitalization in these countries.
One last question.
Thank you, Abi, for an excellent presentation this morning. Our next speaker this morning is Dr. Charles Daly. Those of you who may or may not know Charles, he is the Chief of Infectious Diseases at the National Jewish in Denver, United States. Charles has an extensive experience in treatment and management of patients with MDR and XDR, and we look forward to a fruitful presentation from Charles. Thank you, Charles.
Thank you, Dr. Kam, and thanks to the organizers for inviting me to speak on this very important subject, which is the treatment of MDR, XDR, and really the expected clinical outcomes, at least based on published reports. Before I get started, I wanted to make sure everyone knew about these three documents. There are at least three, there are probably more out there in the world, that are guidelines for the management of multidrug-resistant tuberculosis. If we start at the left, you'll see the guidelines that have been published by the World Health Organization. Those are currently under revision and should be out early 2008. In the middle is a document that I was involved in, which is produced in the States by the Curry Center, the Curry National TB Center, that is also under revision. And the document on the right is the document that was produced by Partners in Health. All three of these documents, I think, are vital if you are managing a patient or patients with MDR and XDR-TB. There's a wealth of information. They all have slightly different approaches, but there's probably more consistency than not. And the very important issues, these are all downloadable from the Internet, so there's no reason why you can't get your hands on these. And again, these will be at least two of these are being revised. When we talk about treating MDR or XDR-TB, we need to think about the strategy. And there are three general strategies that have been discussed, and these are outlined in the WHO document. The first is standardized therapy. Standardized therapy means that you take a representative drug-resistant survey sample or data in a well-defined population, and then you use what you find to design a treatment regimen based on the drugs that for which there's the least amount of resistance. So if someone came in that group, let's say Category 2 failures, or some other group you'd like to define, then you would always treat them with that same regimen. There's another approach, which is you would start with that same standardized approach in any specific patient population that you defined. Again, it could be a Category 2 failure or some other group. You would use drug susceptibility data from a survey to start therapy, and you would then adjust that therapy and thus make it an individualized regimen once you got your DST data. And then the last, which is to start an empirical treatment regimen. The difference there is that every patient, it might be different. And you're going to base that regimen on what drugs the patient has taken, perhaps the underlying prevalence in the community from which they have come. And when your DST results come, you further individualize that therapy. So these are the three general approaches that are used throughout the world. And I'm not here today to tell you which one is the best, because it will really depend on the environment in which you're using it. Depending on the environment and the resources, one may be superior to the other, and I think studies that are ongoing will hopefully better define how we would use which approach. No matter what approach you take, this is what you have to work with. These are the drugs that are available to treat tuberculosis. In this WHO guideline, they are divided into five groups. In the U.S., we often divide them into three, first, second, and third line drugs. So in the first group, those are our best drugs. That's our first-line drugs that we use to treat drug-susceptible TB. They're the most potent drugs, and when we can use them, we will. Group two are the polypeptides and aminoglycosides, again, very potent drugs, injectables. Group three, fluoroquinolones. Group four are what we would call in the U.S. second-line drugs, ethionamide, cycloserine, and so forth. And group five. Group 5 is where you don't want to have to go. Group 5 are expensive. There's typically more toxicity in some of these. Some of them, like imipenem, are only available intravenously. And we have very little outcome data with Group 5. But when we talk about the management of XDR, we are working with Group 5 drugs, and that is part of the problem. And that is why, as you'll see, the clinical outcomes are not very good in the treatment of XDR, because we just don't have potent enough drugs down here at the bottom of the list. There are certain principles I think you need to follow when you're designing a treatment regimen, and again, these are outlined in the WHO guidelines. One is the regimen that you design should be based on what drugs the patient has taken. We know from multiple studies that if you've taken a drug before, and even if you have in vitro susceptibility and take it again, for whatever reason, we don't seem to get as much activity from that drug. So it's important to know what a patient has taken before. It's important to know what drugs and treatments, regimens are available in the country from which they come. It's not always easy to get, and the patient will almost never be able to tell you specifics about their drugs. And then, of course, the prevalence of resistance. These surveys are becoming a guideline for us to understand when a patient shows up in my clinic, Where do they come from? What are the most likely drugs for which they are resistant, their isolate is resistant to? There's been a lot of controversy about how many drugs to use. We don't know. We really don't know. Most of our information on this is anecdotal and based on our just experience. And this guideline is recommended that at least four drugs be used. I think that's a good guideline. I think that's reasonable. But I would also say that we have to be a little open about this. It depends on the drugs you use. Four group five drugs is not the same as four group one, two, three drugs. And we have to keep that in mind when we design that regimen. And someone with a bilateral extensive disease, that's not the same as someone who has a small focus of disease. The drugs are recommended to be given 6 days a week. That varies from country to country, from 5 days a week to 7 days a week. The drug dosage should be determined by the weight, and I would recommend you beware of cross-resistance. More data, it continues to come out regarding cross-resistance of these drugs, and this is something you need to be aware of when you are designing that regimen. A few other issues are the injectable. How long should you give an injectable? First, we think injectables should be given to all MDR and XDR-TB patients. The recommendation by the WHO is to give a minimum of 6 months, 4 months beyond culture conversion. Again, this will vary, and I think it should vary based on what other drugs you're working with and how much disease there is. I can tell you we've treated patients for 12 months with injectable because they had very resistant and extensive disease. Treatment duration, we don't know the answer to this. The recommendation is a minimum of 18 months beyond culture conversion, but again, extensive disease, we'll treat longer. One thing that all guidelines agree on, and that is that this should be given under direct observation. So DOT is critical. If you take what are now being termed pre-XDR cases, that's a new term, meaning that they have one drug away from developing XDR, you don't want to develop XDR by not treating this person with DOT, not maximizing their chance of cure. So DOT is a critical component to treatment of these patients. And then drug susceptibility testing, when it's available and from a reliable lab, should be used to guide therapy. The final issue, we get a lot of questions about this. Well, normally we stop pyrazinamide after 2 months in a drug susceptible patient, and that's based on clinical trial data from Hong Kong. However, in this setting, we don't know how long we should give pyrazinamide. So we recommend, if we think it's an effective drug, particularly if we have in vitro data, that we would give it the entire course of therapy. And that has been our routine at National Jewish for years. So let's build that regimen with those principles in mind. We're going to start at the top, and we're going to pick drugs, as many as we can get, from group one. If we have ethambutol and pyrazinamide available, we're going to use both of those throughout the course of therapy. Then something from group two, and then group three. We don't have time today to go through all the nuances of how you might pick one of these versus the next, but maybe in the question period we can discuss it. If you haven't filled up that four-plus drug regimen that you're trying to design, you move to step two. And in the setting of XDR, you may be moving down to step three. Again, the group five or third-line drugs. It's a fairly standard approach to do this. And if you go by this methodology, you're going to come up with these kind of regimens. This is a busy slide, but let's focus in the upper left corner. Let's say you have a patient who has MDR, resistance to INH and rifampin, plus or minus streptomycin. A typical kind of regimen would be, let's get all the step one drugs we can get, ethambutol, pyrazinamide, then we're going to get our fluoroquinolone and injectable, and you might consider another drug. Why would you do that? Well, you're eventually going to stop that injectable, right? So if you just had the four drugs, including the injectable, for most of the treatment of the patient, they would end up on three drugs because you stopped the injectable. So I want another drug on board. I want four minimum throughout the course of therapy. So I may be starting five in this setting because when I drop the injectable, I'm down to four. We're going to treat for 18 to 24 months beyond culture conversion. The chance of cure in this patient is extremely high, so I don't think surgery would be indicated in such a patient. As we move down the column, why don't we go to the bottom now? That's XDR tuberculosis. Resistance to INH, rifampin, ethambutol, PZA. It doesn't have to be resistance to ethambutol and PZA, but this is worst-case scenario, plus a fluoroquinolone and injectable. So this is knocking out all the really potent drugs. Well, now you're talking about second- and third-line drugs only, and I would want five, maybe six. And we could, again, debate that because there's very little data to derive those decisions. But we're going to treat longer, at least 24 months beyond culture conversion. And as we get into these more resistant patterns, this is where surgery needs to be considered. And this is an important issue that we need to think about. And we recognize surgery is not available everywhere in the world, but I think you'll see with time and with the buildup of XDR-TB that it's going to be an important component of therapy. That's the easy part. That's easy. Figuring out what to treat with is easy. It's actually getting the patient to take it for 24 months and getting them cured. That's the hard part. So a very critical part, and anyone who treats MDR will tell you, on a daily basis, it's side effects. It's drug toxicity that is the challenge. So number one, you need to start off and make sure you have the laboratory services in place to monitor for drug toxicity. You need to establish a baseline, because I can guarantee you there will be side effects and toxicity that you may pick up in the laboratory monitoring, but probably most likely clinically. Most of us have adopted a strategy of slowly increasing the dosage of the medicine. We start at a low dose, and over a period of days, we start bumping it up. The strength in that is that when the side effects occur, you tend to catch them when they're mild. You're able to intervene and control them as you increase the dose. We try to get the drugs on board within a two-week period. There's a lot of discussion about will you induce resistance, but in that two-week period, that is highly unlikely. And because you're going to have to deal with side effects, you need to make sure you have the drugs available. Just simply buying the second-line drugs is not enough. You've got to have the drugs available to treat the side effects, or you're not going to get the patient treated. And then DOT. The other thing that you need to do is look for response. How do you measure response in just with drug-susceptible disease? Bacteriology is the key. This is a figure from a study in Latvia that Tim Holtz, who's here, published, and I think it's a very useful thing because it reinforces in MDR what we know to be true in drug-susceptible disease, and that is the speed with which you convert your cultures to negative predicts outcome. So if you'll note in this figure, you'll see that by 4 months of time, most of the patients had converted. In this column, we see the number of patients converted. And you can see that most have converted by 4 months, and that may surprise some of you. There are some that it takes a lot longer. Yes, we have those patients. It takes months and months. But I think one of the important things to note is of the 167, 125 converted, but a large chunk of those never converted. So if you look at what is a predictor of outcome, of the patients with initial sputum conversion within 60 days, so within a two-month period, their outcome was better. 86% had a good outcome versus 51% who did not achieve conversion. So it is very important to collect sputum and to document when conversion occurs. It tells you if they're failing, of course, by definition, but it also gives you some idea fairly early, is this person at risk for a bad outcome? So what do you expect then? If you use that approach to treat, there are multiple studies. I do not have every study on this in the next slide, but just to give you some idea of outcomes that have been reported, this is MDR-TB with a median resistance of less than 5 drugs, and on the next slide we'll look at 5 or greater. And if you notice, these are done throughout the world, different parts of the world. Much of this is from reference centers, places that specialized and had resources that were greater than most places. The median drug resistance was 3 to 4. You can see the size of the population studied, 37 was from USA. That was published by Marcos Burgos, and that was one of our studies. It was small. And much larger studies, almost 300 in Taiwan. If you look at the cure and completion rate, you'll see anywhere from 45 to 94%. In our small study in San Francisco, a 94% cure rate. But very small, and only 3 drug-resistant TB. Mortality varies also from 0 mortality in our small group to 19% in the report from Argentina. Default varies. You can see, in general, variation in all of the categories of outcome that we measure. And so why is that occurring? Well, this is apples and oranges. We are really looking at very different patient populations within every one of these groups. We also now know, we've always known, laboratory in vitro susceptibility, it varies. It's not as predictive as you think. And so these are very different groups, and that's why we see so much variation from study to study in their outcomes. We see the same in those who have more highly resistant disease. The study from Carol Mitnick in Peru, 75 patients with a cure rate of 73%, relatively low mortality. We look in Florida, in the United States, by a publication by Narita, with a mortality of 32% and only a cure rate of 57%. That is heavily driven by the fact there were many HIV-infected patients in this group. That's another issue here, apples and oranges. How many HIV-infected patients are in the cohort? And this varies. At the bottom, you see a study by Ed Chan from National Jewish, 139 patients with a 75% cure and completion rate, mortality of 11%, default 15, and fail 15. Well, that's at National Jewish, and I can tell you it's hard to garner more resources than we have. And we still struggle to cure these patients. It's very difficult. Those are often centers of excellence, centers in which the drug-resistant patients have been coming for a long time. We now have information from green light-approved projects out in these various countries. And this was a report by Eva Nathanson looking at the outcome in MDR-TB patients in Estonia, Latvia, Lima, Peru, Manila, and Tomsk. And you can see that in terms of treatment success, overall it was about 70% across the group. There was a higher success rate in those who had not been previously treated. No surprise. Again, that shows up in pretty much every study. And you can see some variation, but again, the cohorts here are quite different. One of the things that you need to know, though, they're getting around a 70% success rate in a group that was about 90% previously treated. So this should be a very hard-to-treat population, and they have pretty good success rate in these projects. And certainly people will die. That will happen all the time. But I think the success rate that we see here is pretty impressive given the population that is being treated, which is a very highly treated population. So let's put it all together. And as a clinician or someone running a program, what helps you predict success versus predict failure in this population? Well, success is predicted by the ability to use pyrazinamide or ethambutol if there's in vitro susceptibility, by the use of a fluoroquinolone. In one study from Latvia, using over five drugs was associated with a better outcome than less than that. Perhaps some guidance in this argument about how many drugs should we use. Very importantly, sputum conversion by 2 months that I mentioned, and surgical resection in a couple of studies now has been associated with better outcomes. Failure is predicted by previous treatment, the number of drugs the isolate is resistant to, the presence of cavitation. A couple of studies have shown low body mass index, a predictor of bad outcome. Clearly, HIV infection is a predictor of bad outcome. Poor adherence, not surprisingly. And the reverse of doing well with culture conversion is that if you don't convert by 2 to 3 months, that predicts a bad outcome. So these are useful things for us as clinicians and programs to figure out early on, does this patient have a good chance or not of a good success? And that brings surgery up, which we're going to talk about in a moment. But it's one of those things that would make you maybe think about surgery earlier than later if you had a lot of things that predicted failure. Viral Lemain presented this at an XDR-TB task force a year ago, and it was actually these data that helped push the change in the definition of XDR-TB, because you want a definition that has some meaning to you. And what about outcome? Well, let me get the pointer moving here. So if you look at these different definitions of MDR or XDR. So in this first group here, this is multi-drug resistance with resistance to INH and rifampin, aminoglycoside, and a fluoroquinolone. These are patients who are stratified in a different way. They have MDR plus an injectable resistance and fluoroquinolone. So this would be the current definition of XDR-TB. The first definition, which was multi-drug resistance with resistance to at least 3 second-line drug classes, is here, and then MDR overall. And let's look at cure. The original definition here, we see cure rates that are up over 55%. But if you use the current definition, they drop to 30%. So that definition has some meaning to it. You're not going to do as well as a patient if you have XDR as currently defined compared to how it was previously defined. So that is an important issue, is does this definition mean anything? It does, because Migliori recently just published these data from several countries over the period of 99 to 2006. And this is a very large number of patients, 4,583 with TB cultures. 8% had MDR, 1.4 had XDR. The relative risk of a bad or unfavorable outcome if you had XDR compared to MDR that was resistant to all the first-line drugs was 1.58. You don't do as well. And in this Kaplan-Meier analysis, you can see this is the estimated proportion of treatment success here, the XDR patients here, compared to MDR resistant to all first-line drugs versus other MDR. They don't do as well. Their success rate is getting down into that 50% range. So as we saw in Latvia, 30%, 50%, that seems to be where it's coming out in the 30 to 50% range. We just looked at, Chan just recently looked at our experience with XDR at National Jewish. He looked at 205 MDR patients. 174 had enough data to define them as XDR or not. 6% had XDR. So this is a small number. It's only 10 patients. He divided the outcomes into short-term and long-term. Short-term is basically bacteriologic conversion. Long-term is how was the patient doing as far out as you could follow them. And in some of these cases, it was almost 15 years. In terms of short-term outcomes, you can see here that the XDR patients, 37% success rate, very similar to what's been reported in those other two in terms of short-term, but not very good, very low number, two people, but on a long-term basis, didn't do very well compared to the MDR-TB. So whether you look at short-term or long-term, in our center with extensively drug-resistant cases and usually extensive radiographic disease, all prior therapy, the hardest group to treat, we're not doing a good job. So that brings up what can we do. So I just want to briefly mention the role of surgery. If you read all the text on when you do surgery, we recommend that you do surgery in someone who's failing therapy. And you can define failure different ways. But at least after 4 to 6 months, you ought to have a good idea, is this patient converting their culture or not? And certainly now to today, if there's extensive drug resistance. To maximize your success, you would like it to be focal. You'd like the patient to have clearly or good enough pulmonary function to withstand the surgery. And the surgery needs to be done by people who have experience doing this. This is not easy surgery, and you can very much hurt your patient. In the top panel, you see a standard right middle lobe thoracotomy. Thoracotomy in this case, removing the right middle lobe. But in the bottom, you see VATS, video-assisted thoracoscopic surgery. VATS is how we do most of our surgeries now in Denver. And the point of that is that has changed the way we've used surgery. The risk, the morbidity, the mortality has dropped because of the technique has gotten better and the surgeons have gotten better. So we are now definitely at our institution more likely to do surgery than we were in the past because we have the ability to do it. Now, that's something we have, and not everywhere will have that. But these are some of the outcomes, and this is surgery that's been reported all over the world for MDR-TB. And you'll see many of these reports are from Asia. Operative mortality from 0 to 3.3%, and that was earlier data from National Jewish. Post-op mortality, 0 to 6.8, but again, at National Jewish now, that's more like 2. Morbidity, usually related to things like bronchopleural fistula. And then what I want to point out is that in all of these studies, culture conversion rate is extraordinarily high in the most difficult to treat patients. At National Jewish, one reason, again, that we've started to do more surgery is our own data suggests that there's a better outcome with it. This was Ed Chan's publication, 2004, 205 patients, median resistance of 6 drugs. 130 of these patients ended up having at least one resectional surgery. And in our analysis, both surgery and use of a fluoroquinolone were associated with a better prognosis. And if you look in the right panel here in this Kaplan-Meier analysis, you'll see in the top that the greatest difference or benefit of surgery, this was surgery in those with extensive disease. This was no surgery with extensive disease, and that's where we saw the greatest impact. Over here, it was in those who did not have as extensive disease as determined radiographically. We did see benefit, but the greatest benefit tended to be even in those who had more extensive disease, maybe not what you would think. But I want to point out that surgery is being done in the world. There's a publication recently from Turkey that showed good outcomes. This is from Lima, Peru, 121 patients, highly resistant, median of 7 drugs, who underwent surgery there. About 80% were culture positive before surgery. That's not ideal. You'd like to do surgery when they're negative. And they achieved culture status long-term in 75%. 63% of those who were followed for at least 6 months after their surgery were felt to be cured or probably cured. Post-op mortality, 5%. Okay, that's higher than some others. But if you read this report, they operated on some really sick people with pretty severe lung disease. So I think that these outcomes are pretty good, and I think you're going to be seeing more papers and experiences from around the world in surgery. So that's what we have. It's not enough. I'd like to close with the pipeline is there. There are many discussions about the pipeline for new drugs, and so I'm not going to go into that, except to say that even in the best circumstances, the outcomes are inadequate. They're unacceptable. We cannot accept them. We need these new drugs, and I think until we get these new drugs, we're not going to be very happy with our outcomes for the treatment of XDR-TB. And for some of us, we're not very happy with the outcomes of MDR-TB. So I appreciate your attention, and I'm happy to take questions if we have time.
Thank you, Charles, for explaining a clear presentation on the clinical management of MDR and XDR. I think we have a couple of minutes for a few questions. Please identify yourself and use the microphone. Any questions or comments?
Yeah, Andy Vernon from CDC.
Andy.
Thank you, Chuck. Very nice presentation. The early point you made, which is one that's easy to misremember concerning the issue of use of prior drugs and not counting as susceptible a drug that's been used previously, perhaps even if you have conflicting drug resistance information, is I think a point that's important. And I wondered, when you do your drug susceptibility data, when you're making that decision and you have conflicting information, how do you all approach that? And then secondly, the issue of what's your usual approach, or would you suggest to others as a usual approach, for the patient in whom you're waiting for a full line of susceptibility results and you don't have them yet?
Well, let me take the last one first and then lead to the next one. So if you have a patient that you suspect, you suspect has drug-resistant TB.
Or maybe you even know it's at least MDR, but you don't know the rest of the pattern.
This is sounding very familiar. So you have some, you know they have MDR, but you don't have second line results back, and you have to either guess, and you can guess based on prior therapy, prevalence of resistance that you may or may not know from the area that the patient is coming from, the third thing that you use is how sick are they, and perhaps the fourth is what's the risk of transmission. So all of those have to be used to individualize that decision. There is no cookie cutter in my view way to do this. In general, if the patient is not very sick and we feel like we can quarantine them in some way, we will hold off on therapy often. However, if the patient is in a transmission environment, an institutional environment, for example, or there's immunocompromised people in their environment, we're going to start therapy immediately, and we're going to use those points of interest. Did you get treated before? What did you get treated with? Where do you come from? To make a decision, a best guess. Now, I'll have to say that prior to XDR, this was never a problem, right? Because there were always at least two drugs we would guess correctly about. Today, XDR has changed that because you will run into people who you may not have two drugs. So I think it's made the decision harder. In terms of when you have data that shows in vitro susceptibility and you know the person's taken the drug, I use the drug, but I try not to count the drug. So, for example, ethambutol is a very good first-line drug. I would love to use that drug if I can. But if they've taken ethambutol before, I'm a little wary to count ethambutol, but I'm definitely going to use ethambutol, if that makes sense. So does that answer that question?
Yes.
Okay. There's a hand over here.
It's very difficult to get to the microphone with a loud voice. Turn. The surgery results were very good. Have they been stratified according to immune compromise, HIV status, and CD4 count? Because in my environment, 90% of the MDRs are HIV positive?
That's a great question. So, and I also wanted to preface my talk and didn't. So I didn't discuss HIV because I'm advertising for this afternoon. There's a discussion specifically on HIV XDR, and I didn't want to steal that thunder. HIV is clearly such a predictor of a bad outcome in XDR. And MDR. A recent study from Thailand showed that if you had MDR TB, you were 12 times as likely to die as someone who did not. So I think that this is a key element in the therapy, and I don't want to let that slip, that treatment of HIV in the setting of MDR, XDR is critical. We have a lot to learn about when to start and so forth, but we know in San Francisco, for example, in that small study we had 11 HIV-positive patients. All but one died on therapy, and that was an untreated HIV. We weren't treating HIV back then. So I think that's an important component. In terms of surgery, almost all of these, if not all, were HIV-negative patients. So we don't know the answer to your question.
Chuck, hi. Jay Varma, US CDC, based in Southeast Asia. My concern about surgery has to do not so much with technical proficiency of surgeons, which may be good around the world, but the infection control issues around surgery. We have experience of trying to refer patients for surgical treatment, and they end up in big hospital wards along with all other patients. And so the patients who are most likely to need surgery, those with second-line drug resistance, are those you actually don't want in an institutional setting. And I was wondering what recommendations there are for, I mean, clearly we understand how they should be situated on the ward, but also in the preoperative phase for the anesthesiologists, the respiratory therapists, all the others in the operating room, and what they can do to minimize their risk. Because I would presume the risk is obviously much higher than the patient being on the ward because of intubation.
Well, so that's a very, very important issue. I think the infection control issue, as we keep hearing over and over, is important regardless of surgery. But surgery is just one more element in which infection control needs to be considered. It's also one of the reasons we try very hard to convert the culture before surgery. That's not only an issue related to post-op complications, it's related to infection control. We would prefer to have that surgery done in a patient who's converted. When they have not converted, and sometimes you cannot convert, so you are doing surgery because of that reason, I think the infection control issues are important. It turns out, however, that at the University of Colorado, they don't do anything special. The surgeons in the healthcare put on N95 masks as opposed to a surgical mask, so they do change the way they mask. Anyone involved in the trail of that patient is expected to do that. But within the OR itself, there is nothing done differently. They close that room down for a period of time before they will allow another case in there. They typically do the case last case of the day. These are administrative controls and personal respiratory controls. They're not engineering controls. And they don't know, they've never documented a conversion in any of their staff over all these years. So I think that it doesn't take a lot to protect your healthcare workers, it turns out, if you think about the administrative issues in particular.
Jean-Pierre Telvega from Switzerland. What's your position about the use of isoniazid in high dose intermittently in the assumption that some strains may have still a partial sensitivity to isoniazid?
I took that drug off the list, but we do that all the time in Denver. If we have what is often referred to as partial resistance, not really, but yeah, we use high dose intermittently, like 900 milligrams three times a week of isoniazid. But you know, I don't count it. It's the same issue. Boy, if it works, great, but I don't know if it's working, so I don't count it, but we do use it. And partly, it's been very well tolerated in that kind of intermittent basis. So I do think that's a strategy.
Nice to hear that. Thank you.
So hand at the door.
Thank you. Thanks, Chuck. One question, perhaps in a similar line. We're seeing a lot of chloroquinolone resistance among patients with MDR who don't have resistance to injectables. What's your opinion about the use of more potent chloroquinolones, such as moxifloxacin and gadafloxacin, in patients who have in vitro phenotypic ofloxacin resistance? We're seeing a lot of institutions rely on those drugs.
If you look at how our XDR patients were treated, XDR, fluoroquinolone resistance, 90% were treated with quinolone, usually moxifloxacin. However, we just looked at this in our laboratory, and we're writing this up, which is when you, if you use currently recommended cut points for resistance and you compare moxi, is it susceptible or resistant, to levofloxacin, is it susceptible or resistant, we don't see isolates susceptible to moxi that were resistant to levo. We see, under current cut points, intermediate. We don't know. Should you push the intermediates to resistant, or should you say they're susceptible? And so since we don't know that, we have been using moxi in that setting. We know that there are some programmatic data suggesting that, in fact, using moxi, people think they're getting good results by doing that. Even in the setting of in vitro resistance, we need to see that published. We need to understand, you know, the details there. I think it's reasonable to do that until we know more. I would not count it. I don't count very well, if you've noticed. But,
I think we can only have time for only one last question. Okay, please.
Dr. Daly, thank you for that wonderful presentation. Rocio Hurtado from Mass General and Partners in Health. One of the things we had been struggling with our heavily pretreated patients in Peru was defining when what that threshold was for localized disease and resection, and a lot of our patients actually had bilateral disease. And question is, for those heavily pretreated XDR patients in particular, where you might have some cavitary disease or fibrothorax, but also moderate non-cavitary disease on the other side, where many surgeons would feel reluctant, and particularly in that population where you might expect, given the drug susceptibility pattern, that the risk of BPF and other surgical complications might be higher. Where do you guys fall within for that particular subset of patients?
Well, again, what we do, I'm not saying everyone should do this. We would operate on that patient. We would debulk the worst amount of devitalized lung, necrosed lung, because you'll often convert the patient. You may not cure them, but you will convert them bacteriologically. And in terms of quality of life, that alone is a big deal because people can get back into a different life than what they were, where they were quarantined because they were smear positive for the last 2 years. So we do that. I do think, and let me be the first to say this, that I don't think we have enough long-term outcome in any group regarding surgery. You know, and I think that's a very important thing we need to track down, all of us. And I think you all in Peru probably have the best chance of doing that in this group, is to get some long-term follow-up in them. Because I want to know, too. It seems like a good idea. We've gotten some good results, but I really would like to nail down how good are those results. But we would operate on that type of patient. Okay.
Thank you, Charles, for that.
So now we move on to the next talk. As you may have already seen on the slide, the talk of Jared Kibede cannot be held because he had no chance to come to Cape Town. However, Helen Cox, she's from Australia and had a work with MSF in Uzbekistan. She really knows what's necessary in the field, and she shorthanded was convinced to keep this talk. So thank you, Helen, for this really help in this situation.
We have some space in the front, so those of you who do not mind squatting or sitting down on the floor, you can move to the front space instead of just standing and squeezing yourself at the door.
Okay, good morning. There is an awful lot of people in here. I would just like to talk about some of the difficulties in management of MDR and XDR TB, and perhaps outline some of the key questions regarding scale-up and management to be faced by NTPs, although I certainly can't claim to speak from an NTP perspective. So I think if we start with the question that I think still needs to be asked of, people still need convincing of, do we need to treat MDR-TB. Well, we've just heard this morning that there is an enormous burden of MDR-TB, and it's most likely increasing in a number of different settings and is therefore a major threat to TB control. Despite early evidence that drug-resistant TB resulted in lower virulence and pathogenicity, there is now increasing evidence that MDR-TB strains are actually highly virulent and are being actively disseminated in many communities. So this graph shows a mathematical model published in 2004 of what happens if we just treat drug-susceptible TB. And the black line is drug-susceptible TB. The coloured lines represent MDR strains of different levels of fitness. And what will happen, clearly, is that gradually MDR-TB will take over if we don't treat, if we only treat drug-susceptible TB. There is therefore a clear need to prevent further transmission to treat MDR. But in addition, if we don't offer appropriate MDR-TB treatment through, through good programs, patients who are ill, who are sick and know that they are likely to die, they will seek out second-line drugs wherever they can and using whatever resources they can. And this is a situation that is highly likely to create these very highly resistant strains, XDR-TB. So, due to the threat of MDR-TB and XDR, there is now a new revised global plan, and this calls for the treatment of 1.6 million MDR-TB patients by 2015, an enormous number, with a global budget just for 2007-08 of $2 billion USD. We know that the Green Light Committee has an excellent mechanism to provide access to second-line drugs and to support treatment programs, and they've approved the treatment of nearly 25,000 patients in 40 countries. But this is just the approval for treatment. The numbers that have actually been started on treatment and have even completed treatment are significantly less than that. Indeed, probably less than 2% of the estimated MDR-TB cases in the world are actually even diagnosed as MDR-TB, and even less than that receive treatment. So there is really limited experience in the scale-up of MDR-TB on a wide scale. I think the previous speaker showed slides of the numbers of outcomes from MDR-TB patients, and you can see these numbers are very small compared to the burden of a total of 424,000 new cases of MDR every year that are estimated to occur. So I just thought I'd outline, list some of the challenges that are facing NTPs really in MDR-TB management. So firstly is cost. Second-line treatment is immensely more expensive than the standard first-line regimens and first-line treatment using DOTS. And then, as we also heard this morning, the diagnosis and surveillance for MDR-TB is very limited. There are still large sectors of the world where we have no data for MDR-TB. And these are often places where you would expect, given circumstances, that there may well be a lot of MDR-TB. And then if we look at surveillance and the ability to test for second-line resistance, this is even more limited due to the often quoted lack of laboratory capacity for this. So DST for second-line drugs is needed not just for XDR-TB surveillance, but also in monitoring treatment progress and designing individualised or standardised or individualised regimens for treatment. And also, as we just heard, the enormous treatment burden that is associated with MDR-TB for patients. Very long treatment courses, toxic drugs, a lot of side effects. It's very difficult for patients to stay on treatment, and inevitably there are high default rates. We've just 38% in South Africa is an often quoted default rate for MDR-TB. And given the complexity and difficulty of treating MDR-TB, the human resources needed for this are very limited in the places where there is the highest burden. Human resources for health systems are difficult anyway, so even more so where it requires a significant level of technical expertise. There is also the issue of the development of XDR-TB amongst treatment failures, patients who have failed second-line treatment regimens, and what to do with these patients and how to help manage them. And, of course, infection control in healthcare facilities is a huge difficulty. A quality-assured drug supply for second-line drugs. The GLC has helped this a lot, but there are still difficulties in accessing second-line drugs. And finally, the fear and stigma associated with XDR-TB and these labelled untreatable strains of TB that take us back to the pre-antibiotic era. So I'll just elaborate a little bit on some of these points. So firstly, to cost. Well, this is just a selection of some of the published costs of treating just one MDR-TB patient, ranging from $2,000 up to $90,000 in the US. Even at the lower level of this range, this is an enormous burden for TB programs in many countries. And this is important because there is a risk of drawing much-needed resources away from standardised first-line TB treatment, standardised DOTS programs. And, of course, you need to maintain first-line treatment in improved quality to prevent the emergence of further MDR. So new money needs to be found for treating drug-resistant TB, not just the same. It needs to be new money through the Global Fund or whatever other source. However, I think there are some benefits for treating MDR-TB that can accrue to first-line standard DOTS programs as well in terms of improved laboratory capacity and monitoring. Now, we've seen this graph before, so this shows the treatment outcomes from several of the first GLC-supported MDR-TB treatment programs. Just to say that in red, the treatment failures are significant in all of these patients. And pretty much amongst, certainly in our experience in Uzbekistan, from a reasonably well-functioning program, most of the treatment failures are infected with XDR-TB. So what to do with these patients if they've already failed a second-line regimen is a really difficult question. And if you start to scale up treatment, these numbers will become quite significant. So then if we look at the need for second-line DST, this is a graph from a very recently published paper from here in South Africa, which shows the evolution of one of the main TB strains that's been responsible for the XDR-TB outbreak here. And you can see it starts off as a fully susceptible strain and then gradually becomes XDR-TB finally. And this is... Even so, South Africa has had an MDR treatment program since 2001. The authors of this paper suggest that you need to, therefore, monitor second-line drug resistance through MDR treatment programs in order to prevent the emergence of and the amplification of resistance to become XDR-TB. So I think the issue of to what extent second-line drug resistance testing is necessary for routine MDR treatment programs is very key. Certainly some of the more rapid tests could be developed to also test second-line drugs, which may be very useful. Then if we look at infection control, this has also been very recently published from South Africa. This graph shows the projected impact of engineering measures to prevent nosocomial transmission of MDR and XDR-TB. So, for example, you can see that natural ventilation, improvements in natural ventilation could possibly avert more than 30% of XDR-TB cases. And also the accommodation of patients either individually or in patient clusters. On the whole, these are fairly simple, affordable infection control engineering measures. To note also that the same paper looked at personal protective measures such as masks and more administrative measures such as limiting length of stay. But the impacts of those measures for infection control were actually much less in this model. So it's probably the engineering measures that will have the most importance. Given the complexity of treatment for MDR, there will always be the need for hospitalisation. So infection control will always be significant, although clearly we have to try and reduce the level of hospitalisation to some degree. But irrespective of this, I think it's important to note that infection control is not just for the patients who are diagnosed with MDR and XDR-TB. These are probably just the tip of the iceberg of patients who are actually infected with drug-resistant TB strains, since most of them are actually not diagnosed. And so therefore, in a similar way as to the introduction of universal precautions for HIV prevention, infection control actually needs to extend just beyond not just the ward that's labelled the MDR-TB ward. And then finally, if we look at... these are some news headlines from South Africa over recent months that have actually made international news as well. And they're quite horrifying for any of us who have been involved in treating MDR and XDR-TB patients. And this sort of environment of these headlines and what they create, the climate that they create, is clearly not conducive to people seeking diagnosis and care for TB. It's very sad that the labelling of XDR-TB, extensively drug-resistant TB, which was probably done to increase international profile of this problem and to raise funds, has actually had a negative impact in many settings, probably here in South Africa. So I think this is a really important issue that we need to be concerned about how we label patients and what impact that has on our efforts to control drug-resistant TB. So then if I start looking at some of what I think are the key questions, and I think the last speaker also has highlighted that really the regimens that we have are not... they're not brilliant. We're disappointed with the results that we have at the moment. So optimising treatment regimens with the currently available drugs, do we use all of the available drugs, the number of drugs that we use, these sorts of questions. In terms of our experience in Uzbekistan using ofloxacin, do the newer fluoroquinolones have a lower risk of developing XDR-TB amongst treatment failures? Are questions that I think we need to address. In terms of the pipeline for new drugs, well, clearly we need new drugs, both for first-line and second-line treatment. But what should be the priority? Should it be to shorten first-line treatment or for more effective and less burdensome second-line MDR-TB treatment? Or can we... There's a typo in this slide. Can we use new drugs simultaneously as first- and second-line? What is the discussion around the use of new drugs? Given the risk of nosocomial transmission and the difficulties for patients of spending very long periods in hospital away from their families and support structures, clearly we need better models for ambulatory treatment of patients. What's been termed decentralisation here in South Africa. Connected to this is how to train and support healthcare workers to provide treatment and care and provide and to devolve treatment down to a lower level but still maintaining the technical skills required to treat patients. And then secondly, how to engender sort of civil society's support for a treatment program. This is a picture from the march this week. Protesting against the lack of action on TB, which was very encouraging. But I have to say that South Africa is probably more advanced in terms of activism than many other settings where we have MDR-TB problems. So But I think it's an issue that NDPs have to try and grapple with of how to engage communities in TB in general and drug-resistant TB. And then given the infection control issues, piloting combinations of strategies to reduce nosocomial transmission and sharing that experience is clearly very, very important. And then on to the last slide of key questions. How do we actually treat XDR-TB patients who have failed a second-line regimen? Do we continue to treat them with high-dose isoniazid or whatever with the aim of reducing infectiousness rather than the aim of cure? What are the ethical implications around this? What do the patients actually want? How can we better support them to perhaps live in the community, support their families, health education? There clearly needs to be a balance between care and support and reducing community transmission, but these are big issues that I don't see a lot of discussion about. And then to conclude, I think we really need to operationalise different models and strategies for MDR-TB and XDR-TB treatment in different contexts, not just in different cultural and geographical rural-urban contexts, but in terms of the epidemiology, settings like South Africa with high HIV prevalence, settings like where I have worked in Central Asia with high MDR-TB prevalence, but at this stage low HIV. And then crucially, settings that at this point have relatively low MDR-TB or no data at all, and how do we prevent the emergence of further MDR-TB through systems to treat patients as they appear? I think there is a basic challenge in aiming to simplify and standardise drug-resistant TB treatment, given the complexities and the difficulties that there is, balanced against the need to standardise and make more simple to scale up drug-resistant TB treatment. And this is balanced against the complexities and the difficulty. But I think we really need to think much more innovatively about models of care. So I think I'll just leave that there. Thank you very much for your attention.
So thank you, Helen, for this very nice talk. And I think you really tipped some of the important questions about the management of the MDR and XDR, mainly XDR patients in those high incidence settings. I think we have some time for some questions. Please, over here.
Thank you for the question. I just want to make a comment here. I'm Norbert Njeka, medical advisor, MDR-TB for URC. I just want to say that I'm very pleased with the presentation. One of the slides that struck my mind was the presentation, the slide on the cost. And you would see that the cost from Peru, Lima, Peru, is the lowest of all. Compared to our own cost in South Africa, we spend on average $5,000 to treat one MDR-TB patient. We all buy medicines from, we know the manufacturers are the same. Now, what we've seen in literature about Peru is that their program is largely community-based as opposed to ours, which involve admission during the intensive phase. I stand to be corrected here, but this is the impression most of us have, that in Peru, you do it outside, outpatient-based. We admit for 4 to 6 months, hence our cost has to be higher. But now my question is, has someone looked at the social cost of treating MDR-TB outside with all the infection control measures, the risk to infect communities and all that? If it's true, the program in Lima, Peru, is largely outpatient-based. Can we hear about the social cost? Because we're really having a debate in South Africa. Should we do it outpatient based? Should we do it inpatient? The majority of us feel that there's a great risk to leave the people out there. They have to be admitted until they are non-infectious. But then there are a lot of challenges like you've presented. But can we hear more about social cost of keeping the people outside the hospital in Peru and many other countries that are doing that? Thank you.
Yeah, no, that's a very good comment. I think it is very much something that has to be developed in for each individual context. In terms of social costs, I think if you are treating patients in the community, you very much need to provide a lot of support, nutritional, psychosocial care. I have heard that in some places they actually build another room onto a house in some places where that patient can have their own space, which is a good infection control measure. All of these things, the transport costs for patients, and all of these things are probably actually much less costly than having a patient in hospital. So I haven't seen a really detailed analysis of all of the costs, but somebody else can perhaps help.
I'm from Partners in Health. I'm just wondering whether any of our Peruvian colleagues are here. Jaime Bayona? Do you want to comment?
That's a very good question. I think one of the data that Dr. Daly showed and was from Latvia, but on the time to bacteriologic conversion. Similarly, even in our heavily pretreated patients, most patients did achieve bacteriologic conversion within a few months. So yes, there is definitely that time before treatment when they're infectious. When you look at household contacts, and there's a concomitant session that Dr. Becerra is conducting this morning, a lot of the transmission had happened before actual treatment implementation. And so one can also argue in areas of high prevalence of HIV, such as in sub-Saharan Africa, that actually by hospitalization, the risk of reinfection when there aren't great infection control measures is another cost that one needs to take into account. So I think it's a worthwhile question, but very complex.
Yeah.
I would just add that I think the dangers of transmission in the congregate setting far exceed the dangers of transmission in the community, with some reasonable precautions that people should not socialize in those first few weeks in large groups. But and as Rocio just said, there's plenty of data going back to Madras that most household contacts are infected by the time you diagnose the case.
Yes, I would agree. Mm-hmm.
One question? So we will have time for one last question, please.
Can I make one comment and then one question? The comment is that probably the biggest treatment problem I have in our NDR group, other than actually treating the patients, is their socioeconomic disaster that follows their hospitalization for themselves and for their families. And that is an extremely difficult issue to treat. Mm. The other comment question I would like to throw out here is, do we have a protocol, or should we have a protocol for withdrawal of treatment? We do it for many other disease processes, and it may not be a satisfactory outcome for a clinician to have a dead patient, but in a patient who you're unable to treat, should we continue to treat and let them die slowly and progressively, or should we withdraw treatment?
Yeah. I mean, I would agree that that's a really important issue to consider. But I think also our experience in Uzbekistan is that often the patients who, when you withdraw treatment, these are what's been termed the chronic cases who will remain alive and infectious for many years. And so there's another dimension to that as well. They don't all die very quickly when you withdraw treatment. But yes, I agree. I think we do need to really start dealing with that difficult question. Yeah.
Okay, thank you for a very nice presentation. As was announced earlier, Dr. Massau from South Africa could not make it for this meeting, so we have to skip her presentation and go on to the next one. This presentation will be by Dr. Katharina Burmi from Switzerland, and she'll be presenting on the alternative tools for detection of MDR-TB in resource-limited settings. Thank you, Katharina.
Thank you, Cam, and I thank especially those of you who've been standing now for more than half an hour, 1.5 hours for your patience. I was asked to give a relatively short overview over new tools in the detection of TB, since there will be a symposium tomorrow that goes into the details for many of those methods. I'll focus a little bit more on the tools that are supported by the Foundation for new innovative new diagnostics, simply because that's where I have most data on. As Helen has already mentioned, fewer than 5% of the existing MDR cases are currently diagnosed. A priority of the global MDR and XDR TB response plan is therefore to strengthen the laboratory services and to provide adequate and timely diagnosis of MDR and XDR TB. The plan calls for the deployment of rapid diagnostic tests, access to rapid rifampicin testing, especially in high HIV prevalence settings, and the expansion of the capacity for first and second line drugs. Well, what alternatives do we have to solid media for drug susceptibility testing now and in the near future? Many of you probably know that in June 2007, liquid culture and drug susceptibility testing on liquid culture in low- and middle-income countries was endorsed by the WHO's Strategic and Technical Advisory Group for TB and subsequently issued as a WHO policy. The higher costs of liquid cultures have been addressed by price reductions for the public health sector of low-income countries. This endorsement was largely based on data that were provided through Find Midget demonstration projects. These were conducted in four DOTS Plus programs in four countries, and I just briefly give you the results here. We clearly showed a higher rate of mycobacterial isolation that was most remarked in smear-negative, culture-positive specimens, with 94% positives by midget compared to only 41% by LJ. The studies showed the feasibility of conducting midget only. As you can see, 93% of the patients with any positive cultures were positive in midget alone. The shorter time to detection, medium time to detection for case detection was 9 days with midget, and another 9 days for to obtain the DST results. Salman Siddiqui and Françoise Portels are also working now on the possibility to use midget for direct drug susceptibility testing. A high concordance between midget and LJ DST results was clearly shown. But on the other hand, we also saw a much higher contamination rate and a relatively frequent detection of non-tuberculous mycobacteria compared to LJ. Several of the sites initially showed contamination rates in Midget of over 20%, but for all sites, we managed to get the contamination rates down to below 10% over 1 to 4 months. The high detection rate of non-tuberculous mycobacteria clearly makes it necessary to identify species for all positive cultures. Now, in order to maintain the benefit from the shorter time to detection, it is essential or critical to do this species confirmation with a rapid test. Along with the midget, we have evaluated a test called Capillia TB Neo that is produced by the Japanese company Towns for MTB complex confirmation based on MPT64 antigen detection. This assay provides a result in 5 to 15 minutes. We've tested it in, we've tested 15,000 tests meanwhile in over 12 countries and saw excellent performance data in all of these settings and a very low need for training or support. Second line DST using BACTEC Midget 960 or manual Midget. Now, several laboratories in, for example, Uzbekistan and Nepal have introduced second-line testing based on Midget using the critical concentrations that were published by the groups of Sabine Ruscherdes and Francis Drobnevsky. However, these critical concentrations clearly need to be confirmed in larger evaluation studies, and we need a rigorous standardization before we can roll out Midget for second-line DST more widely. In the following, I'll give a short overview over some of the in-house culture methods. For many of them, new data were presented here at the conference over the past days. For all of them, however, more data on operational feasibility is needed and larger evaluation studies to confirm the performance so that none of them is, in my view, ready to be rolled out. The nitrate reductase assay, based on the reduction of nitrate to nitrite, first described by Sven Hofner's group in 2002. This year, there was a publication promoting nitrate reductase as direct method for drug susceptibility testing in smear positives. The time to detection for the indirect method in average 10 days, 14 to 28 days for the direct method. Promising sensitivity and specificity data for rifampicin resistance as well as isoniazid, but clearly more evaluation data needed. Colorimetric redox indicators such as Alamar blue, they're all based on the reduction by the mycobacterial metabolism. There's been a good meta-analysis by Martin in 2006 that showed sensitivity and specificity ranges of 89 to 100%. Aerosol formation and the possibility of cross-contamination clearly have to be considered. Thin layer agar has been around for quite a while. Based on microcolony detection on 7H10 agar. Also there's now new data that assess this method for direct drug susceptibility testing in smear-positive samples. The median time to detection, 10 days. For rifampicin and isoniazid resistance detection, 11 days. Promising sensitivity and specificity also here. Clearly more data needed. David Moore gave a very nice presentation at the Diagnostic Working Group meeting on Friday on MODS. The principle of MODS relies on the same cording as for the thin layer agar method, but the growth is faster due to the use of 7H9 growth. The publication in the New England Journal of Medicine clearly showed that MTB detection with MODS is rapid, even more rapid in that publication than for the Bermariobact alert system and so for liquid culture, sensitive, and showed a high concordance for direct rifampicin and isoniazid resistance with a medium time to detection of 7 days. Now, what you can see here on the lower left side, that's actually really interesting. The time to detection for MOTS seems to be independent of the bacterial load. So the mean time to detection for smear-negative samples was about the same as for smear-positive samples. This should clearly be investigated, especially in high HIV prevalence settings. MOTS at this point is relatively cumbersome and laborious, with frequent reading with the inverted microscope and a lot of reagents needed. However, there's a significant potential for simplification, and there is the possibility to turn MODS into a product or a kit. And that would help to avoid problems that may occur during implementation, such as quality assurance, standardization problems, supply and distribution problems. Now, even with the best liquid cultures, the time to detection is at least 7 days. Given the high mortality, especially in high HIV prevalence settings for multi-drug resistance and LTB and XDR-TB, more rapid diagnosis is needed. And South Africa was the first country that decided that it wanted to introduce a rapid test for MDR screening. FIND is therefore conducting demonstration studies together with the MRC South Africa and the NHLS. We're conducting large-scale demonstration studies using the HEIN MTBDR Plus assay, one of the two available line probe assays, in 4 laboratories in South Africa, and we'll test 20,000 sputum specimens from high-risk MDR suspects. The test is conducted directly from smear-positive samples, and the outcome measures are operational feasibility, impact, and cost-effectiveness of implementation. Most of you, I think, will know the genotype MTBDR plus assay. The assay is based on conventional PCR plus reverse hybridization of amplified DNA to oligonucleotide probes on strips. The RPOB, the CATG gene, and in the new assay version also the INHA gene are examined. The patterns from these bands can be interpreted as RIF and or isoniazid resistant or sensitive. Now, the assay had clearly showed very good sensitivity and specificity data already before we started the study in South Africa. What you can see here is concordance data in already directly for smear positive data, but in very small number of samples. And these are the first data from the validation study in Cape Town in 536 patients. What you can see here is data that are almost too good to be true. A very, very high sensitivity and specificity for both rifampicin and isoniazid detection, and a very good prediction of multi-drug resistance. There was a significantly higher proportion of MTBDR plus results interpretable compared with the conventional DSD results. And so far, no DNA contamination has been seen, despite a relatively high throughput of, in average, 48 samples per day, and in the meantime, more than 6,000 specimens tested. What I left out, because I thought I wouldn't have enough time, is rapid testing with this assay for XDR, and Helen and Charles have pointed out the potential, the meaning for this. infection control, informed infection control, informed treatment decision. The HINE platform has the potential for such a rapid XDR test. And there's more and more data available on mutation localization for both fluoroquinolones and aminoglycosides. FIND has started development of such an XDR rapid test in collaboration with HINE. The development time is estimated to be between 12 and 15 months. All of the assays I have described so far, due to their complexity or due to their biosafety requirements, remain limited to the highest level of the health system and therefore will always have a limited impact. Now, what we clearly need is a drug susceptibility test for the lower level of the health system, for the level of the microscopy centers. FIND is therefore collaborating with an American company called Cepheid that has developed a platform called GeneXpert for anthrax testing in the United States. Now, we are working with them on the development of a TB assay for TB case detection and rifampicin resistance. This assay will be fully automated with completely integrated sample preparation, amplification, and detection, and will provide you with a result within 120 minutes. The platform is based on heminested real-time PCR molecular beacon technology, so fairly complex technology, but very simple to use. All the user will have to do is to add sample treatment buffer to the raw sputum, wait for 20 minutes until the sample is inactivated, then transfer some of this mixture to the cartridge, insert it in the GeneXpert, and we'll have the result 90 minutes later. TB, yes or no? Rifampicin resistance, yes or no? The GeneXpert platform will be available in several sizes, from a 1-module size, 4-module, 16, 48, and 76 modules. And it is important to say that it is a technology platform that can not only be used to diagnose TB, and especially in this context, I think it will be important to make it available for viral load testing, so that viral load could be detected in the same platform than TB. We are currently conducting feasibility studies for this test in Peru and Latvia, and what we see is very good operational performance data and very, very promising sensitivity and specificity data in smear-positive as well as smear-negative TB. In summary, the MIDGET DST for first-line drug susceptibility testing is available now and will be available very soon for second-line drug susceptibility testing. More evaluation and implementation data are needed for in-house culture methods. Data for the MTBDR plus assay will be submitted to STAC by March 08 and then hopefully endorsed by WHO by August 08. And the expert MTR assay for rifampicin resistance detection at a lower level of the health system, the microscopy center, will undergo evaluation studies in early 2008. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Catherine, for a nice and clear presentation this morning. The floor is now open for discussion. We have a few minutes for comments or questions.
Yes. One quick question. What is the role of PCR in detection of MDR-TB? PCR.
So the two technologies, the two molecular technologies I've described, the HINE assay and the expert TB assay, are both PCR-based methods. We expect that the role of PCR, simplified PCR especially as in the last case, will play a more and more important role for the diagnosis of TB and drug resistance.
Amal Basili, WHO. Amal Basili, WHO Regional Office of the Eastern Mediterranean. I'm interested to know if you have an idea about the cost effectiveness of the different new diagnostics.
Technologies, yeah. Well, so we include cost effectiveness analysis in all our demonstration studies. So there is fairly detailed data for the MIDGET demonstration project. I'm not the expert on this because there's consultants that work on this. But so the costs for the MIDGET, as far as I know, were $9 for case detection compared to 8 for LJ. And this is all applying the new prices negotiated for low-income countries. And for drug susceptibility testing, INH and rifampicin, $24 for MIDGET compared to 18 for LJ. Well, we looked at a smaller number of smear negative samples, and the performance was even very high in these specimens, which were only about 25 so far, but the assay showed a sensitivity also in these cases of, I think, 80%, Heidi, isn't it? Yeah.
I wonder if there's somebody else has a lab question. I wanted to make a comment on the previous talk, but so anybody has a lab question should.
Well, so we can only do that for the demonstration studies, not for the earlier phase trials. And in the demonstration projects, treatment is based on the results of these tests. So, for example, in the case of South Africa, treatment decisions are based on the result of the rifampicin, of the HINE rapid test. And there is patient data available on the outcome. And again, there's consultants hired for that. But Heidi, do you want to say more on that? No. Yeah. So there will be outcome measures, treatment outcome data available.
Ed Nardell from Harvard and Partners in Health. Just one quick comment again on the community-based treatment. It occurred to me. It seems that nobody can keep patients in the hospital for 18 to 24 months. That's certainly not possible. And in those programs that don't have a good follow-up method in the community, the results drop off after the hospitalization phase dramatically. I think South Africa has seen that, for example. So once you realize you have to build a community-based program to complete therapy, you have it for early in therapy as well, and it becomes less necessary to hospitalize anyone for a long period of time. So I think, you know, it really we need to focus on the community-based treatment.
Oh,
Okay, any more comments and questions? If not, we can thank Catherine for her excellent presentation this morning. And I'd really like to summarize the session for us.
Dear listeners, I want to thank the four speakers for their very excellent talks. They gave us a very good overview over the situation. We heard about the dimension of the problem, what we are dealing with. We learned a lot about treatment, at least in situations where you have all possibilities available. However, we also learned about the challenges of the treatment of XDR and MDR patients in high incidence settings where we have less possibilities. And finally, we also learned a lot about new and promising techniques that maybe enable us in future to better control the problem and maybe lead, help us to reach the WHO goals. We are all convinced to reach them. Maybe you want to have a short final comment.
Okay. I'm a laboratory person, so I just like to give some comments to the physicians and program people that the generation, the creation of MDR and XDR-TB is not by the lab. The lab only detects those problems created by physicians who only know monotherapy, who only knows nothing about DOS, and the program has a lousy DOS program which will generate MDR and XDR. So for those of you who are working at physician level, individual level, please go back and read up your textbooks or whatever. And please do not go with monotherapy anymore. Combination therapy with a number of drugs, as Charles has highlighted, they are difficult, but they are the only way out for the physician and also for the program. I think for the program people, I think that the message is extremely clear this time that creation of MDR and XDR rests on our shoulders, and the lab is only the last line that we can stand in this fight against MDR and XDR. And with this, I thank you all for coming to this morning's session. I hope we can have further discussions in the coming years and also coming symposia. Thank you all for coming this morning.